All right. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and fellow conversationalists around the world, and welcome once again to the Politics Cafe at www.hernco.com, the best in Internet talk radio. The Politics Cafe is a small cafe located on an isolated stretch of the information superhighway, where we get together once a week and grill up some fresh topics for your digestion. And yes, fresh topics aplenty we have. First and foremost, hats off to the New Orleans Saints. What a job they did yesterday in the Super Bowl. I'll tell you, folks, going into the bowl, I was telling everybody, no way in hell. If you were smart, you will not bet on this. You could lose your money. It could go either way. You know, your chances of hitting something yesterday were going to be just as good buying a lottery ticket. And I said, but if you must go, you got to go with the points, because I figured it was going to be a very close game. I mean, I was looking at this game being within 2 points, one or the other there. And seeing as how the line, the official line on it was Colts -4, well, I was going to say, you got to take the points at that point in time. Well, at any rate, the New Orleans Saints did just a brilliant job. Just a brilliant job yesterday. I could not believe they opened up the second half with an onside kick, that they recovered, that they carried down in there and put themselves back into the game. And then a two-point conversion that was ruled no good at first, and then got ruled to be it. I'll tell you what, that sparked them onwards. And at that point in time, there was no stopping them boys, man. They did one hell of a job. New Orleans has every right to be proud of them. God bless them. They did one hell of a job, I'll tell you. It was great. It was a good game. One of the best Super Bowl games all around that I've seen in a long time. People say, first half was boring, blah, 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 blah. But no, I ain't buying into that. You know, I thought the first half was pretty damn hard, well fought. And the guys did good. All right. Well, anyway, offwards, upward and onward into the news. Folks, now you tell me whether or not you believe the Iranian government is having problems. Now, a lot of people have been talking right along here about, you know, these people have got to get themselves attacked from the outside in order to rally their people around their flag, around and get them back together. Because right now the Iranian people are protesting their own government in a very hard way. They have been. They've been crushing a lot of small revolts over there. 9/10 of what's going on you don't hear much of. However, the Iranians have opened up the Internet to certain select Iranians to go out into the world and start broadcasting their own brand of propaganda. It's funny how they've been actually invading PalTalk. We've run into quite a few of them here over the last week. But this, it came down off the AP tonight, should tell you something. It's by George John, Associated Press writer. Iran pressed ahead today with plans that will increase its ability to make nuclear weapons as it formally informed the UN Nuclear Agency of its intention to enrich uranium to higher levels. Alarmed world powers questioned the rationale behind the move and warned the country it could face more UN sanctions if it made good on its intentions. And don't forget, folks, this is on top of the missile launch that they pulled off last week, where they claimed to have put a shot of missile all the way into space. Iran maintains its nuclear activities are peaceful, and an envoy insisted the move was meant only to provide fuel for Tehran's research reactor. But world powers, fearing that Iran's enrichment program might be a cover for a weapons program, were critical. Britain said the Islamic Republic's reason for further enrichment made no sense because it is not technologically advanced enough to turn the resulting material into the fuel rods needed for the reactor. France and the U.S. said the latest Iranian move left no choice but to push harder for a fourth set of U.N. Security Council sanctions to punish Iran's nuclear defiance. Even a senator parliamentarian from Russia, which traditionally opposes Western ambitions for new U.N. sanctions, suggested the time had come for such additional punishment. Konstantin Kosachev, head of the International Affairs Committee of the State Duma, the lower house of parliament, told the Interfax news agency that the international community should react to this step with serious measures, including making the regime of economic sanctions more severe. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad had already announced Sunday that his country would significantly enrich some of the country's stockpile of uranium to 20%. Still, Monday's formal notification was significant, particularly because of Iran's waffling in recent months on the issue. And the article goes on and on, but folks, you get the gist of it here. They went right out to the international community today, and whether or not they're even doing it, we don't know. This could be another Saddam Hussein trick for all we know. You know, make sure the world gets good and scared of us. that they won't do anything. But I think this guy's doing just the opposite. I think he's having such a hard time holding on to what little support he can get from the people that he really thinks the only way he's going to get any support and get the people together is to find an outside enemy that they can concentrate on. Try to get the outside enemy to come and attack. And I think that's all this move was today. I think it was strictly a move, not diplomacy, but just a move to get the world to start moving on him so he can rally his own people. Because it could be the only thing he has left. There's nothing else in Iran right now that they got to offer to people. The people are upset. People do not like the economic situation. They don't like the tyranny that he's imposing. They don't like the way they're cracking down on all the demonstrations. Just having a rough time with everything over there. So this is it's almost as if you could count on this to come down and just that's the word I'm looking for. Well, at any rate, you guys catch a drift of what I'm saying here. Iran looking to get the world to throw the first punch. And I don't. It's not making a very smart move in this because he who throws the first punch hard enough may not need to throw another. And of course, on top of that, Hillary Clinton is out there saying it's time for more sanctions now because of this. And of course, she'll play right into his hands, you know. I'll tell you the funny part about all of this because I was, really expecting just the opposite to come out of Iran and other Middle Eastern countries right about now. I had figured that for the first 2 or 3 years of Obama's presidency, that the Iranians and even the Palestinians and other terrorist organizations throughout the Middle East would be doing all they can to mollify Barack Obama, to tell him, no, we're not going to start anything. Give the man the best sense of a false sense of security that they could, you know, so that he would indeed, in fact, pull everything back out of the Middle East, make it all nice and quiet. And then once they had the place to themselves, they would just have their new surge just take over and become stronger than they were in the past. And it really seemed to me like that would have been their move. But this guy in Iran, he's not along with anybody else going on in the Middle East over here. He's on his own. He's doing his damnedest to hold on to the tenuous little grip on power that he's got right now. And it ain't working out for him. Just ain't working out for him. All right, upwards and onwards into the news here. We got what the hell was, where's the one I was looking at? Chris, I got so much stuff piled up in front of me here, it isn't funny. Okay, now, they're trying once again to try to save this health care plan for all it's worth. Now, there was one out here today, and I know I got it right in front of me here somewhere. I got to excuse me, folks, coming down with something here good tonight. And, I got the single malt medicine sitting here in front of me. It's working. We're only going to have a one-hour show because of it. But it's just plain, all right, here we are. The Obama administration today asked California's largest for-profit health insurer to justify plans to hike customers' premiums by as much as 39%, a move that could affect some 800,000 people. In a letter to the president of Anthem Blue Cross, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said she was disturbed to learn of the planned increases, calling them extraordinary. I believe Anthem Blue Cross has a responsibility to provide a detailed justification for these rate increases to the public, Sebelius wrote. She said the company should also make public what percentage of customers' premiums go to medical care versus administrative costs. In a statement, Anthem Blue Cross of California blamed the weak economy and rising health care costs for the rate hike, while pledging to reply to Sebelius's query promptly. The state rate, or the rate hike, highlights why we need sustainable health care reform to manage a steadily rising cost of hospitals, drugs, and doctors, the statement said. Sebelius said Anthem's Blue Cross parent company, WellPoint Incorporated, has seen its profits soar, earning $2.7 billion in the last quarter of 2009 alone, not counting roughly $2.2 billion a gain from the sale of a pharmacy benefit management subsidiary. WellPoint earned $536 million in the final 3 months of last year. In a rare move, California Insurance Commissioner Steve Poizner is hiring an outside actuary to determine whether Anthem is abiding by state regulations and spending at least 70% of the premium dollars on medical care as opposed to administrative costs. Now, Poizner spokesman Darrell Ng said that the only recourse because rate hikes do not need to be approved by the state. Now, in a letter Monday, Poizner asked for the insurer to delay implementing the rate hike for 2 months until the actuary completes his review. Now, folks, they're going on more excuses here. But we've been hearing all over the internet about how people who are paying for the big plans have seen theirs jump, you know, and we're talking 39% to 40%, and a lot of people as such are dropping these plans and heading on to other ones. Now, the nice part about these big plans that you're going to spend a lot of money on is that they cover everything. You don't even have to pay anything when you go into the doctor's office, you know, $3 and $5 prescriptions and whatnot. And it's it's good for them, but people are looking at, you know, how much is it that they're actually saving over, you know, paying for their own doctor visits and whatnot. And this is exactly where it was going to head. Now, everybody's wondering, well, how come they all went up like this? Answers are simple. A lot of people are losing. Their costs do not go down. Their costs are rising, which is another thing, okay? And, well, everybody wants to listen to this or not. All right, yes, there are always going to be new technologies coming out in the healthcare field. People are working on it all the time. But when you start seeing rates having to go up 30 and 40%, you better believe it's for another reason. And I'm here to tell you that that other reason is strictly inflation. It's as simple as that. There's no need to get around it. All right, inflation is the big killer here. We are starting to see this inflation seeping into lots and lots of things out there, and it's going unnoticed by the government. It's going unnoticed by the CPI. Folks, you know, I don't know how many of you guys out there actually do the grocery shopping, but if you don't, talk to the person in your family that does do the grocery shopping. Now, I myself, I do it here, and I'll tell you, over the last couple of months, I have watched groceries skyrocket. I'm watching the price of everything take a big climb. Coffee up to, you know, I can't think of the size container I'm buying, but it's $10, $10.99 for that. I'm looking at, we bought a Christmas turkey this year. That Christmas turkey was the first time in my life I ever bought a turkey that cost me $50. You know, yeah, it sure does. And then again, you're looking at the prices of everything going down. Or I'm sorry, the size is going down. You know, look at Lay's potato chips. Everybody likes Lay's. Well, let's not get around it. You should take a look at the size of the big bag of Lay's potato chips. Remember the big bag that used to be a two-pounder that went for, 99 cents, you know, and then after a while it went down to 1 pound, and it was $1.99. Well, that 1 pound is now down to 11 ounces, and it's $3.99 for an 11-ounce bag. Now, that 11-ounce bag was 14 ounces 2 months ago, all right? But, you know, it's $3.99, but you're just not getting the potato chips you were getting before. And we're seeing this everywhere, everywhere in the store. Even the price of bread's going up, the price of eggs, the price of milk, the price of all the canned goods. Campbell's soup has gotten beyond belief, you know. I mean, I'm looking at cans of Campbell's soup that are $1.59. Even Pepper Pot, the cheapest crap in the world, made out of tripe, is $1.19 that I can remember, you know, feeding my own kids, you know, when it was 19 and 29 cents. My kids aren't that old. Of course, yeah, they're grown up. Yeah. But so what? You know, it's the point that I'm trying to make here is that everything is going up all across the board right now. You know, people are looking at economy cars out there that are going for $20,000. You know, folks, it hasn't been that long since I retired out of the car business. You know, in the mid-80s, in the early 90s, you know how much it cost you to buy a Chevy Cavalier? You know, I sit here and tell people that the new car then was under $10,000. You know, they were between $7,500 and $8,500 bucks, depending upon how you wanted to be equipped. Oh, that's not true. I said, well, you go take a look at the prices of them. You know, if you wanted to go all the way to a Buick LeSabre went for $17,999. That was the sticker price. And they were basically, I mean, the only two or three options that you could get added to that was maybe a sunroof and something else. I forget, something stupid in the trim. But beyond that, that was the price of the car. Well, I'll tell you, by the time 1998 rolled around, that exact same car was at $28,640. It had gone, and it's insane. You know, now we're seeing the exact same thing here. You know, and people, you know, price of gas going to set 8 cents this week, but we're back up to $3 a gallon for gas for most places. And, you know, as my buddy Bumbledore here in the room at Pal Talk is telling me, you know, 3 cents here, 5 cents there, it all adds up. Yeah, it sure does, you know, and every little thing out there. And you're getting kicked in the ass with it. You know? Now, the worst part about it is you hear all these damn politicians tell us, oh, well, inflation's under control. Well, you know, the only reason that they could say that is because of what Bill Clinton did years ago when he changed the way the CPI was figured, when he removed things like heating oil, removed, food, other items that, that most of us use out there on a day-to-day basis had to go from the CPI because they were just too volatile. You know, well, what it was what was too volatile was the actual inflation that was going on out there. Same thing that we're seeing here today. People are not being fooled by it. It's a nasty thing, and it's going to keep on going. And I'll tell you what, folks, it doesn't bode well for anything. You know, I don't care how much health care reform they bring about. Until they do something about inflation, health care is going to continue to rise. And until they can do something about the job market, all insurances are going to rise. I'm sorry, this is, you know, what you're looking at here with this insurance rate is also the fact that there are less people buying insurance. You know, and in some of the states, like here in Massachusetts, a lot of people just gave up, said to hell with it. You know, the state is going to make me buy this plan. Well, that's the plan that I'm going to buy. Anything else I'll just pay for out of pocket or I ain't going to worry about it. Thank God you can still get decent health care in this state. You know, it's pretty good. And I got to admit, I've heard a lot of good reports about what people are telling me here. I got good reports, you know. I know my wife's a heart attack a couple of years ago. I mean, the prompt treatment and care that she got on that was stupendous. You know, for what happened here at our local hospital, Fairview Hospital, from the diagnosis and whatnot they made on her, to the fact that they, you know, within hours, she was shipped down to Bay State Medical Center in Springfield. And with hours of arriving there, they had performed the surgery where they put a stent in one of her arteries. I mean, it was, there was no joking around here. You know, they got everything done quick. And it was amazing. And, you know, her recovery is coming along pretty good. She's feeling a lot better than she did. And, you know, I think that they're actually talking about starting to wean her off of some of the heart medicines that she's been on for the last 2 years. So I think it's, you know, I'll tell you what, I think it's working out pretty good for everybody involved here. It really is. All right. Now, moving on and on. At any rate, this whole healthcare scheme is going down the tubes in a big way in this state, or I'm sorry, in this country. You know, they're basically putting it on hold. However, I got one here that I did want to talk about. They're talking about sneaking it in the back door here. There was something else, and hey, I'm sure it's going to come up here. At any rate, let me see where we got. Oh, John Murtha died today, folks. Representative John Murtha, the tall, gruff-mannered former Marine who became the de facto voice of veterans on Capitol Hill and later an outspoken and influential critic of the war, died today. He was 77. Pennsylvania Democrat had been suffering from complications from gallbladder surgery. He died at Virginia Hospital Center in Arlington, Virginia, with his family at his bedside. I'm not going to say anything bad about John Murtha on his deadbed. I'm not that kind of guy. You know, I'm sure he will be missed by all of his family and some of his constituents, no doubt about it. Interesting to see who replaces him up there in Pennsylvania, though. Whether or not they stick to the progressive leanings that are there, or whether or not, you know, something else comes along. Now, I'm sure they're going to have a special election to fill his seat. I would at least think so. You know, he's got a lot going on here. Yeah, there, Crazy Coffee. How you doing, bud? Yes, John Murtha passed away today. All right, I got 10 minutes before we get to the bottom of the hour here. The lawmakers now investigating Toyota's recall include a senator who was so eager to lure the Japanese automaker to his state that he tramped along through the fields as its executives scouted plant sites, and the congresswoman who owes much of her wealth to a Toyota dealer. They and others on the congressional committees investigating Toyota's massive recall represent states where Toyota has factories and the coveted, well-paying manufacturing jobs they bring. Some members of Congress have been such cheerleaders for Toyota that the public may wonder how they can act objectively as government watchdogs for auto safety and oversight. The company's executives included a former employee of the federal agency that is supposed to oversee the automaker. Toyota has sought to sow goodwill and win allies with lobbying, charitable giving, racing in the American and his Apple Pie NASCAR series, and perhaps most important, creating jobs. Now, will those connections pay off as it tries to minimize fallout from its problems? Now, the Senate's lead Toyota investigator, West Virginia Democrat Jay Rockefeller, credits himself with lobbying Toyota to build a factory in his state. A member of the House investigating panel, California Representative Jane Harman, represents the district of Toyota's U.S. headquarters and has financial ties to the company. Rockefeller, chairman of the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committees, has known Toyota's founding family since the 1960s. He was so closely involved with Toyota's selection of Buffalo, West Virginia for a factory that he slogged through cornfields with Toyota executives scouting locations and still mentions his role in the 1990s deal to this day. By the time Toyota decided to make Buffalo its new home, Rockefeller said in 2006 during the plant's 10th anniversary, I felt like a full-fledged member of that selection team. Now, Rockefeller's committee is expected to review whether the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration acted aggressively enough towards Toyota. The agency's new chief, David L. Strickland, worked for 8 years on Rockefeller's committee as a lawyer and senior staffer. Strickland has such close relationships with Rockefeller and other senators that Republican Senator George Lemieux of Florida asked Strickland at his confirmation hearing 2 months ago whether he could disagree with Rockefeller, his former boss. The oversight for you and your role will be from that committee that you once served on, Lemieux told him. I will be honest with you, sir, Strickland answered. I've had disagreements with the chairman personally, but he signs the paycheck and he wins. But I will have no problem with that all, sir. So, you know, we'll wait and see what's going on here. At any rate, a lot of folks, now you guys all know I've been in the automotive business most of my life. It's where I made my money. And I worked as a mechanic for years and years, and I worked as a salesman later on. And, yes, I owe most of my life to the automotive business. And a lot of people would always say, oh, you're a conservative. You don't want any of them Japanese cars, do you? Even though they're better. Well, to be honest with you folks, I've never been that way. You know, for a long time I worked on nothing but Subarus. I really love the cars. I thought they were great little cars. I never had any complaints with any automaker per se. You know, they all did what they did. As far as I could see, they all built different products. Each one of them had its good points, and each one of them had its drawbacks, you know. But they're asking me, well, what do you think about Toyota here? You think they're just a bunch of bums now or what? I'm saying, no, you know. And I also do not think that this is a government conspiracy out to try to plant Toyota in order to sell more GM cars. I think what's going on here is an honest engineering mistake. And I think Toyota will work its way out of it pretty damn quick, no matter what it costs them. I think they're going to end up replacing the brakes on all these Priuses. I believe it's a Prius. It's got the, you know, they're not even so much a bad brake. It's just that they're not quite as sufficient, I believe, at least from what I'm hearing. They're not quite sufficient to do what needed to be done. So, you know, it's not a big deal to change out brakes on a car. It really isn't. You know, and I mean, you know, even if it gets right down to having to change the backing plate, the drum, the disc, whatever it is, it's, you know, they will pull it off there. If it costs them a couple $300 a car, well, hey, shit happens. But still, by the same token, I will not believe that this is a government conspiracy. Unless, of course, that you start seeing the other manufacturers get nailed. You know, now if Nissan comes under fire, could be a problem. Some of the European car companies come under fire, could be a problem. You know, if they go after their beloved Subarus, then you're going to be a problem. However, the one car that I think that will remain exempt from all of this will be the Volvo. Now, don't forget, folks, most liberals out there, okay, come in one of two designations. They either can drive or they can't drive. Now, all of the liberals that can drive will be separated into two piles. You will have 5 to 10% of them that really do believe in green and will be buying the hybrid cars, will be buying these small economical cars, will be thinking about the environment, will be thinking about saving energy, will be thinking about all the wonderful little political factors. The other 80% of the half that can drive are driving SUVs. Generally driving the big SUVs, the Cadillac Escalades, the big Mercedes-Benz, the Lexus, the big Toyota, the Honda Pilot, all the great big monsters out there, you know. But the Volvo now and the others, yeah, wait, everybody does. Well, Bumbledore, the soccer moms, you know, you're not going to tell the soccer moms out there that she can't have her SUV. It's that simple. She bought it for safety, period. You know, the environment is going to take a backseat to safety of the soccer kids. You know, the gas mileage is going to take a backseat to safety. Everything will. Safety is her number one thing. She wants to feel safe, and she wants all her kids in there to feel safe. You know. Now, on the other hand, there is the bunch that cannot drive. We all know who they are because you see them going down the road in a Volvo. Now, this bunch of people, folks, these are the hardest of the hardcore left. All right, the really stupid ones, the ones that couldn't pour piss out of a boot if the instructions were written on a heel. All right, these people have already been in several moving accidents throughout the course of their driving careers. They know that the next accident is a matter of inevitability. It will happen. There is no getting around it. They just want the safest car possible that they can get around them. Now, Volvos have always been nightmares as far as a service concerned. But people who own Volvos don't care. Okay, whatever it costs to get the Volvo fixed and keep the Volvo running, they are going to do. Count on it, you know, and they will not gripe about it. Same with Subaru owners, by the way. You know, like I say, when I worked on Subarus for years, people that owned those cars would always tell you, you know, whatever it needs, you know, it just, you know, I want it looked at. And you would always find something, you know, the damn, the dust boots that sat on the CV joints were always falling off of the damn things. You had to put them on there, you know, at least once a year, if not every 18 months. They needed a new exhaust system that ran into thousands of dollars. Brakes on them were always expensive. They needed clutches. They needed a lot of other stuff. And everybody, you know, and the thing about it is, if a Volvo owner, or I'm sorry, but a Subaru owner brought you his car for an oil change, he expected you to whack him with $150 to $300 worth of extra work. Now, an American car dealer is going to come in, or American car owner is going to come in and question everything you say. What do you mean my car needs $300 worth of work? Runs fine. Stops fine. Steers fine. I don't need this. You can point it out to them. But the Subaru owner will just say, okay, no problem. Please do it. And, you know, and then, of course, you know, every 3 months this goes on with these people. You know, they get their oil changed. They spend another $150 to $300. Now, when it comes time, you ask them 3-4 years down the road, how's carbon treating them? Fine. Never needed a thing, they'll tell you. Every single one of them. Every time. It never needed nothing. It was a good car. You know, despite the fact that they had already put 2 or 3 exhaust systems on the car, maybe an axle or two, put at least one clutch in it, had the brakes replaced several times. Never needed a thing. It was a good car. So I had no accounting for their, you know, for the common sense or reality with these people. They just like the car. That's the way they're going to have it. But I'm here to tell you, folks, at any rate, before we go to break, that, you know, if the government is, if people in the government are going to be involved in attacking foreign cars, okay, trying to make our cars look better, I think they would actually be going about this a different way. I really do, and I think that they would be attacking them on a much broader scale. So for all the conspiracy theorists out there who believe that the Democrats would stoop as low as to try to drag Toyota into a fray to sell more GM and Chrysler, nah, I'm sorry. I can accuse them of a lot of things. You know, and I do believe that they are still the rotten bastards that I believe they are. But this one here, nah, I can't even put this at being low enough for them. At any rate, folks, we're at the bottom of the hour here. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to the Politics Cafe. My name is Mark Belcher, and we'll be right back.
On your hair every day, and do you want a good hairstyle every day? Hi, I'm Sarah Schuster. I went on a website called InventNow.org, and after that, I decided to invent something too. Something called the Insta-Do. Just imagine, you just put it over your head like a helmet does, and you pick your hairstyle with the buttons on the side. Then you can have instant hairstyle in seconds. People like it. People like Jeff Bart.
I like it.
And people like Kenneth.
It's this helmet thing, and it fits over your head, and it's
great. Thank you, Kenneth. You should go to inventnow.org, and it could help you come up with your own invention. After all, look at me on the radio now.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions, or just play some games at inventnow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Right now, nearly 30% of U.S. students aren't finishing high school. In many places, it's even higher than that. And fixing it is a responsibility that we all share. This is President Obama, and I urge everyone to take responsibility for encouraging the high school students in your communities, to support them, challenge them, and do whatever it takes to help them make it through.
Do your part by going to boostup.org and giving a student the boost that's needed to make it to graduation. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it? Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called inventnow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on and lost cats stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See? That's proof. You should go to the inventnow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at inventnow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Have you ever dreamed of being a karate master? Well, stop dreaming and start chomping with the Karate Glove.
Hi, my name's Molly, inventor of the Karate Glove, and I have just 1.5 words for you. Hi-yah!
The Karate Glove chops through anything. Just put it on and instantly chop through wood. Hi-ya! Concrete. Hi-ya! Brick walls. Hi-ya! Trees. Hi-ya! Small cars. It can even chop through these 8 guitars. Hi-ya! It chops things.
If I can invent a karate glove, just imagine what you can do. Visit inventnow.org to get started on your invention. Anything's possible. Keep thinking.
Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
It's hi-ya time!
And we're back. You're listening to the Politics Cafe, www.hernco.com. And, hey, folks, sorry about the little interruption there. We had a standby cooking and new guy come into the room here. Welcome to the room there, Raw Radio. This is an internet broadcast going out over www.hernco.com, the best in internet talk radio. All right, folks, some of the other things we're going to talk on here about. Now, here's something insane. The Europeans are just not buying this. But this down off the AFP News Network tonight, unauthored, as always, from the AFP, but good article. Strasbourg, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has urged the European Parliament not to block a U.S.-EU deal on the transfer of banking data, which Washington says is key to the fight against terrorism. Euro members of Parliament, concerned about protecting European citizens' personal data, are threatening to veto an interim deal when they vote on it Thursday. European governments have already endorsed the 9-month agreement permitting U.S. authorities to justice authorities to data from the Interbank Transfer Service, SWIFT, but the deal needs EU parliamentary backing to have legal weight. The Parliament's primary concern is that personal information, including data from electronic bank payments, could be transferred to U.S. authorities and handed on to other governments and agencies. A longer-term agreement must be negotiated, and the Assembly fears the interim deal may set dangerous precedents and tie EU hands in future negotiations. However, Clinton, in a letter to EU Parliament President Jerzy Buzek, stressed that the terrorist finance tracking program agreed it is to our common efforts to prevent terrorism. Now, Clinton's joint letter with her Treasury colleague, Timothy Geithner, expressed our sincere hope that the European Parliament will consent to the interim agreement, which provides narrowly targeted and valuable data, fully protects individual data privacy, and is subject to multiple layers of review and oversight. Right. Yeah, where do you get folks, I gotta interrupt this here for a second. But how do you get multiple layers of oversight and protect personal data? Excuse me. I mean, I'm sorry, but that just doesn't compute. Now, The letter seen by AFP piles the pressure on from Washington after U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, William Kennard, warned in a separate missive last week that Washington may stop working with EU institutions on terrorist data exchange if the deal is blocked and work with European capitals directly. Clinton's message was a little more conciliatory, stressing that any future negotiation with the EU and the FTTP must be conducted in a manner that enables Parliament to be able to make an informed decision on whether to grant consent. The letter also voiced confidence that the Parliament's view will be heard, considered, and responded to by the EU Commission, Council, and the United States during negotiations on the successor agreement once the interim deal is in place. Now, the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, SWIFT, based near Brussels, deals with trillions of dollars in global transactions daily between nearly 8,000 financial institutions and 200-plus countries. In 2006, SWIFT admitted that it had provided U.S. authorities with some personal data in the wake of September 11, 2001 attacks for the purpose of fighting extremists, but insisted it had done its utmost to protect privacy. A previous agreement no longer applies, and the flow of data has been suspended since January the 1st. U.S. officials say the information is only subpoenaed once a month, so it is only now that an intelligence gap is appearing. You don't spell now with a K there, buddy. A U.S. official said that since the system was put in place in the wake of the 9/11 terror attacks, Washington has handed European authorities some 1,500 reports built from information gleaned from the data exchange system. European Union may always be aware of that, as the source of the information is not routinely included for security reasons, he said. Well, all right, folks, look, this is just a sneaky ass sideways slide attempt to try to find more Americans who are hiding money in Europe. You know, as if any of them are going to be dumb enough to hide it in a paper trail where it can happen. Long time listeners to this program will remember. Christ, almost a year ago, one of Obama's first moves was to have Timothy Geithner get in contact with UBS. Remember, I was talking to a couple of guys that work for UBS. I played golf with them last year, and they were telling me all about it, too. Geithner was over there in Switzerland doing his damnedest to get the Swiss to divulge the account information of 55,000 Americans because of what he believed to be tax cheats. Basically, people hiding their money overseas so that it could not be taxed. Now, this is obviously 55,000 Americans who were too stupid to do it in such a manner that, you know, they could get away with it. This is the way I looked at it. You know, and I don't believe that the foolish amongst us are the majority. Especially in the financial world, the foolish amongst us are the minority. And yet that minority consisted of 55,000 people. Now, here's the point, okay? Now, suppose it's a strong minority, and it's 25%, okay? Well, that still leaves you 200,000 people out there who are managing to hide money in something overseas. But I'm here to tell you, folks, that I think that it's probably a closer to a 3 or 4% minority, which would put the numbers of people hiding money overseas in the millions. Now, obviously, there's no way in hell they're going to be able to get at that account information. UBS, basically, UBS, after having given them some information, found out what was going on here and turned it down flat beyond that. There's no way. I mean, Swiss banking laws are Swiss banking laws. It's that simple. They are where they are because they have always been safe, they've been secure, and they have been immune from other countries' pressures to give up anything. Well, this, folks, is just a backdoor attempt, you know, by the Department of State and Timothy Geithner. And I'll tell you something, if it was just Clinton doing this, you might sit there and question it. All right, but she's got Geithner on the letter with her. I'm sorry. Timothy Geithner, all right, Treasury, Secretary of the Treasury, okay, is not involved in terror. Timothy Geithner, Secretary of the Treasury, is involved with the Treasury. He is involved with the IRS. He is involved with collecting taxes, yes. Despite the fact that he was a tax cheat, his job is now to at least make it look like he's going after other tax cheats. you got to love the guy. You really do. But, I mean, this is just, it's foolish. It's foolish to sit down and think that there's anything beyond this, you know, other than exactly what Timothy Geithner is trying to tell you here. You know, it's insane, but it's, look, folks, come on. You know, let's be real about all this. we know where they're headed with this. We know where it came from. And it's I don't know how far they're going to get away with it. We will see. At any rate, here's the next one I had sitting here right at the top. Okay, this is by Stephen Collins down off the AFP. Republicans staked out a tough bargaining position today and demanded President Barack Obama shelve his massive health care reform plan after he cajoled them into a summit on his top priority issue. The February 25th meeting will be live on television, forcing Republicans to publicly justify their opposition to Obama's signature reform plan, which has now been calmed with deep political implications for his presidency. If the point is to listen to the Republican ideas and really consider them, the president's announcement is very welcome, said Senate Republican Whip John Kyle. But Kyle also hit out at the indications that the White House has no intention of ditching its effort to pass a sweeping, comprehensive health care plan. Such preconditions suggest the White House is not serious about genuine negotiations, Kyle said. A large majority of the American people strongly oppose the Democrats' massive bill, and the Republicans will not abandon them. Obama's new gambit reflected an apparent acknowledgement that he will need at least some Republican votes to pass the historic measure, after Democrats last month lost their vital supermajority in the Senate. But it was unclear whether he was ready to offer genuine compromises on the bogged-down plan or was simply trying to paint Republican foes into a corner. Obama unveiled the new strategy in a CBS interview Sunday at a record television audience tuned in for the Super Bowl and previewed the political theater sure to develop during the meeting. That's why I didn't watch anything ahead of time. Just turned it on at 6:30. How do you guys want to lower costs, the president asked during the interview, paraphrasing questions he would ask Republicans. How do you guys intend to reform the insurance market so people with pre-existing conditions, for example, can get health care? How do you want to make sure that the 30 million people who don't have health insurance can get it? What are your ideas specifically? Now, Republicans, after complaining for months that their ideas on health insurance have been ignored by Democratic leaders in Congress, had little option but to welcome the summit. But they signaled after the mounting blanket opposition to the Obama program, they have no intention of folding under political pressure. Senate Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has the power to block Obama's reform agenda after Democrats lost their 60th seat Sunday, said the president must put his mammoth health bill on the shelf. Now, McConnell argued Obama's efforts would result in higher taxes and cuts to the Medicare health program for the elderly, a charge the White House denies. Well, I'm sorry, but it's exactly what it was going to do. We also appreciate the opportunity to share ideas with the president, particularly on an issue where Americans have spoken so clearly, McConnell said. And, let me see here. I lost my place here. At any rate, folks, it goes on and on. No need to finish this entirely. What we're looking at here, okay, is nothing more than a setup. Now, I don't know how many of the Republicans out there are listening to my radio cast here tonight, but I am going to be sending off emails to each of them that they plan on having in this February 25th summit. And I'm going to tell them the smartest move that they could possibly make is not to show up at all. Don't give the man the chance. Don't sit down there and tell him that you have any plans for it. You know, unless you're just going to go in there and say, hey, excuse me, sir, but we think the federal government doesn't belong in the healthcare business, that the federal government should be out of the healthcare business, and that if any government wants to get involved with it, they should leave it to the states. Now, if you're going to say that to them and drop it at that, that's fine. Otherwise, what they're going to be looking at getting themselves into by showing up at this is nothing more than a bunch of poo-pooing, nothing but a bunch of catcalls. All they're going to be doing is setting themselves up to get shouted at, to get shouted down, to get their asses beat. I was them. I would not even bother showing up at this meeting. I would not give that president the time of day on this subject. You know, I'm sorry, but this great community organizer, okay, who has failed to look at the power of organizing communities into performing their own health care and decided to take it away from the communities, needs to get spanked here. Needs to get spanked really big on this bill. And what needs to happen is for the leaders, for the real leaders in the community to start taking this back. The states need to be taking back health care. They need to get the federal government out of it. Period. Federal government getting itself involved in any health care issues whatsoever should be a no-no. It is not; they're not constitutionally authorized to do any of it. at or anything else. Jenny Allen Keyes was not coming into this room tonight. Sorry. But you're welcome to hang out here. Allen Keyes actually never made it into the room that he was supposed to tonight. I guess evidently the weather in Washington was down, what have you. Sorry, we do have him lined up for here at some point in the future. We just don't have a date nailed down yet, but hey, he'll be on board. It's a tough call, you know. Actually, we got a show coming up here. What I'm working on, folks, you guys know, long-time listeners of the show, I'm pretty good friends with Duncan Hunter, and also very good friends with Lieutenant Colonel Alan West and a few other prominent Republicans. My plan down on the future here, before we get too far in, or at least before spring and things really start heating up for all these campaigns, is to help them set the agenda for the Republican Party. And, yes, I will be getting into that coming on down a line, down the road here. It's, you know, there's a few things that if the Republicans want to win that they could do. And I'll tell you what, I got a few minutes left here tonight. You know, and aside from doing what I'm telling them here as far as just don't even show up at the Obama's healthcare summit. Just leave him sitting there talking, you know, give that man exactly what, you know, what they should be doing, which is just ignoring him and saying, no, you know, we're going to block anything you're going to do, you know, with the, you know, with the whole entire reason being, sorry, but it's beyond our constitutional limits, you know. As a matter of fact, I mean, if you really wanted to make a case for it, I would turn around and say, look, this violates the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment, establishing a religion. Healthcare per se, any of the sciences, any of the rest of it, all are bound by faith. All are founded on a faith. And the way I see it is they are trying to practice a faith when they engage in it. It's that simple. So it's time for them to wake up, understand that what they're doing is the wrong thing here. And in order for them to do the right things, to put it right back in the hands of the religious community from whence it came. Get it out of the hands of government. Government is there to do nothing more than secure your rights. That's what government was formed for, to secure the blessings of liberty upon us and our posterity. That is what is outlined in the Constitution of the United States of America. Healthcare does not belong in it. Okay? People got to turn around and understand something. That a government, and government's only power, and the only power that any government has ever had has been nothing more than you know, its power of force. Its ability to provide aggression where aggression is necessary. Now, I'm sorry, but I am one of them kind of old fart type peaceniks that does not believe that it's ever correct to initiate violence against another person, to initiate aggression. We have a federal government and we have a military and armed forces that are out there standing to repel aggression, to crush aggression where it starts and when it starts. Yeah, that's right. That's right, folks. I agreed with the Iraq war, and I agree with what we're doing over there now, because it was a source of aggression against the world, and it needed to be put down, and that's exactly what we're doing over there. Okay? Islamofascism is a source of aggression. It needs to be squashed. Okay? And what's more than that, it's going to need to be replaced with the principles of liberty. At any rate, I think that one of the biggest things that these guys could do, if they're going to show me that they're going to be serious, is to start working on a community organizing level to get their states, their districts, their communities on some sort of a health care plan. And as a matter of fact, I'm still touting what I thought Mr. Kent Conrad, Democrat of North Dakota, had come out and said quite a few times, that he believed in the idea of health care cooperatives. And I think that that is the best idea I've heard from any coming down the road. Okay, there are food cooperatives, there are clothing cooperatives that are all working rather successfully around this country. People join them, people belong to them, they pay their dues, and they get what it is that they want from them, and they're all very, very happy with it. The cooperative market that we have here in my town, despite the fact that yours truly will never go in there, don't like rubbing elbows with liberals. It's just all there is to it. But I would be a fool to sit here and deny that it was a successful business. Okay, I know all these people go there. That parking lot is always full. There is always people going in and out of the place. Hey, yeah, God bless them is the way I see it. You know, if they built that place to keep me out, it was successful. You know, but if they built that place to provide themselves with the foods that they want to eat, their organic, macrobiotic, whatever the Christ in hell it is, hey, go for it. God bless you, folks. You know, you're doing something on your own without my input, without any need for me to subsidize it with my taxes. All right? I have no problem with what the hell you are doing on your own, and I would feel exactly the same way about healthcare. You know? Look, I believe that small insurance companies are already basically cooperatives. All right? I believe that some of these cooperatives could be instituted by the religious. You know? The Catholic Church, the Episcopalian Church, plenty of Hebrew institutions have built some of the greatest health care facilities that we have in this country. No reason to take it out of their hands and put it into the hands of the federal government, all right, which really has nothing else at its power but the use of issuing force. That's all it's ever had. That's all any other government's ever had. And you got to wake up and say that. You know, a lot of people complain, Mao Zedong, Mao Zedong made one very, very acute observation. That all government power comes from the muzzle of a gun. You know, and I'm here to tell you something, folks. You know, that is exactly the truth. You know, now, despite the fact that Mao Zedong was able to take that government power and start wiping out millions of citizens, doesn't mean that it's any less of a threat here. When the government is going to turn around and give you anything, it has to take that something. Take what it's giving you from someone else. And if it's got to use a threat of aggression or the threat of violence or the threat of force against that person to take it from them, when is it that you wake up and you understand that they are doing wrong? And that when you condone them or you're asking them to do that or you are voting for the representative or the senator or whoever the hell it is out there that's telling you he's going to do that, that you are wrong doubly. Because not only are you voting for the wrong thing, but you are aiding and abetting and conspiring with someone else who is willing to do the same thing. And I'm sorry, but it is just plain wrong. If you want to see these things handled, if you want to see social issues handled, then get out your goddamn Birkenstocks, put them on, and go to work and go do it. That's the way I look at it. If you think people need more health care, okay, and it needs to be cheaper and more affordable for them, well, then you go get yourself a degree in health care and go give it to them at a cut rate. That's the way I think it should be. Or you need to talk other people into helping pay for it, you know. But you got to get people to volunteer for it. And this goes right back to, you know, what Thomas Paine said a long time ago, that governments, you know, have been so confused. Well, let me see. As a matter of fact, I'll bet I got this quote sitting right up here. It's, yes, some writers have so confounded society with government as to leave little or no distinction between them, whereas they are not only different, but have different origins. Society is produced by our wants and government by our wickedness. The former promotes our happiness positively by uniting our affections, the latter negatively by restraining our vices. The one encourages intercourse, the other creates distinctions. The first is a patron, the last a punisher. Society in every state is a blessing, but government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil. In its worst state, an intolerable one, for when we suffer or are exposed to the same miseries by a government, which we might expect in a country without a government, our calamity is heightened by reflecting that we furnish the means by which we suffer. Government, like dress, is the badge of lost innocence. The palaces of kings are built upon the ruins of the bowers of paradise. For were the impulses of conscience clear, uniform, and irresistibly obeyed, man would need no other lawgiver. But that not being the case, he finds it necessary to surrender up a part of his property to furnish means for the protection of the rest. And this he is induced to do by the same prudence which in every other case advises him, out of two evils, to choose the least. Wherefore, security being the true design and end of government, it unanswerably follows that whatever form thereof appears most likely to ensure to us, with the least expense and the greatest benefit, is preferable to all others. All right. And that, folks, was something very well said. You know, and it's just as applicable today as it was when it was written. As a matter of fact, this was February the 14th. Almost, 1776. So we're looking at, 234 years ago to the day. Coming right up here, folks. But nothing has changed since then. You still got idiots out there that confuse government and society. You know, it's just unbelievable. There'll be more on this next week, folks. You know, I'm going to get into a couple of things. We're going to start talking. You know, pretty soon the things are going to wind around here where I do want to get into what I believe that winning candidates, the qualities and the actions that winning candidates will possess and will be taking for this fall in this ejection election of 2010, where we throw the bums out. We start getting real people back in there that understand, you know, what's going on. I think it's, you know, there's a few things that need to be said. I think there's a few things need to be said on how they should be acting in their own communities and in their own districts. And I think there's a few things to be said on how they should be acting in Washington. And I think there's a few things that need to be said on how they keep in touch with their public. As a matter of fact, I think there's quite a few ideas out that can be had that would help solve a lot of problems that are going on out there. But at any rate, folks, we have hit the top of the hour here, and it's time for me to close the show up. I promised you only 1 hour. My voice has only got 1 hour in it tonight. But next week, we'll be back. I don't know, at some point here, these shows are going to move to Saturday, but I'm not quite sure when. I have to get down with Bob. Bob must be having a lot of fun. I have been lately, too. I got to admit, folks, a band is cooking right along. Tomorrow night, we are trying out a new singer and a keyboard player. And should be working out really, really good. We went and listened. It's a female girl, and her name is Jessie, and she's an incredibly talented piano player. Tomorrow night, we're going to go and play with her and hear her sing. We're actually going to do this in a bar in front of a whole lot of people tomorrow night. So it's